This is the Plant on the Line program here at thecommentary.ca. Business journalist and author Andrea Mendel Campbell was the Mexico bureau chief for London's Financial Times and a correspondent for Business Week magazine in Argentina. Her work has appeared in a number of notable publications, and since returning to Canada in 2002, she was a feature writer at the National Post and has also appeared in Maclean's and The Walrus. She's the author of a new book, Why Mexicans Don't Drink Molson, Rescuing Canadian Business from the Suds of Global Obscurity, a wake-up call of sorts calling on Canadian companies to play a larger role in the international marketplace. She points out the too few successes Canadian business have had abroad and the potential that still exists. Published by Douglas & McIntyre, Why Mexicans Don't Drink Molson retails for $34.95. Andrea Mendel Campbell was on the line with me from here in Vancouver.
Welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Andrea Mendel Campbell. Good morning, Ms. Mendel Campbell.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Spent much time in South America, Latin America, covering as a business journalist. Do you think you gained some perspective about Canada being away from it?
Well, I think that's probably what changed my entire perspective on Canada. When I left, I had certain, perspectives on Canada and just assumptions about what our country was like, how it was built, what it stood for, and what it achieved internationally. And then, of course, you go abroad, and your perspective widens significantly. And I think the shock is even worse when you come home, probably, and you see your country in a different light.
A critic of your book appeared in one of the local papers here in Vancouver. Said the obvious answer to your book's title is maybe it's because Mexicans are dirt poor and Molson sucks.
Yeah, I read that, and I mean, unfortunately, that's the perspective of somebody who's probably never left Canada. There is a kind of a certain thought here in Canada that of, you know, how they think the rest of the world works, and these are people that, like I say, never tend to leave. They completely missed the point of the book entirely and didn't understand it. Mexicans drink copious amounts of beer. They are great beer lovers, and in fact, it's very different from the rest of Latin America. If you go to South America, they really don't drink very much, and if they do drink, they tend to drink wine or hard liquors. But Mexicans love beer. So in fact, the problem is that they don't buy it because we never bothered to sell it to them.
What is that, though? I mean, you use Molson as an example, beer as an example. Canada's outlook abroad, is that complacency, a lack of leadership, do you think?
Yeah, there's definitely a part of that. I mean, part of the problem is, in the case of beer, and you can apply this really across the board to many industries in Canada, is, you know, they've been complacent and on one hand and hamstrung on the other by government regulations and a certain competitive environment in Canada that ensures that, you know, companies here can make an amazing amount of money with relatively little effort. So, you know, they can basically essentially not even bother to package their products. They sell them in, you know, dirty brown bottles and in that way save a huge amount of money and make a great profit. And you know, in the case of Ontario, they have a government-seeded retail monopoly where they own the retail distribution point for their products. So they don't even have to distribute or retail their beer. They just sell it at the beer store, which is, anybody who's ever been there, the salespeople wear rubber gloves and the beer comes off a conveyor belt. So there's not a lot of effort put into marketing, I would say, really packaging, retail, any of that stuff. So, and yet they make a fabulous amount of money. So on the one hand, it's really, makes them complacent. On the other, going international becomes anathema to them because they're never going to make that kind of money with such little effort going into any other market. And they're at the same time completely unprepared, as we found with Molson in Brazil, where they basically blew the company and had to sell out because it's so much more competitive and they're really just not prepared for it. And I'd say the other problem is a definite lack of confidence on the part of Canadians in general, who somehow think that if it's for Canadian consumption, then the rest of the world simply wouldn't be interested in it. And I actually interviewed a gentleman for the book. He used to be the head of marketing for Black Label, Black Velvet Whiskey. And he had approached, he tells an interesting story about how he approached Molson and said, listen, I think you could make a killing in Russia. I think you could make a killing in Brazil. I've got great contacts. He already knew how to, you know, market liquor internationally. He said, I think we can, you know, you could really make a killing selling your beer as a premium import into these markets. And Molson's response was, we really don't believe we could ever get a premium for our product. They found it amazing to think that somehow a Canadian product could compete against a Heineken. They just didn't believe enough in themselves or in their own product to think that they could garner a premium internationally.
That lack of self-confidence, though, is that just relegated to business people or business leaders? Do you think that's something that Canadians have?
I think it's something that we've kind of nurtured in the culture for a very long time. I just think that it manifests itself in business, but, you know, I think a general, you know, that whole concept of how Canadians like compromise, you know, the whole middle of the road kind of ethic that we have, I mean, that's about, you know, about not being able to make a decision, really. In my mind, it's about being a fence sitter. It's about not really being able to sometimes assert yourself and, you know, just strike out and be bold and kind of have that boldness of claim and doing something. So I think it's kind of inherent in the nature of the Canadian identity, so to speak, and you just see it manifesting itself in business and in many other ways.
So you think business leaders should have more of an imagination. Governments aren't really known to have imaginations of their own. What should government do, do you think?
Well, I mean, government, I mean, they're no different than we are. I mean, we're all Canadians. They didn't arrive from another planet. I think the problem is that you see that lack of leadership everywhere. I mean, leadership is something, like the concept of leadership is not something that's ever really been nurtured or encouraged in Canada. We have more of a pack mentality, I think, here. You know, protection in numbers. And so you end up, you know, and that's the same in government. It's very hard to find, you know, strong leadership among government and to make decisions that I think sometimes might not be the easiest ones to make, but, you know, have a vision and a long-term, you know, kind of plan for the country. And I think that's something that we've always lacked, a strategy. And, you know, people have said to me, and I actually quote somebody in the book saying, you know, if you can have a plan for a company, how can you not have a plan for a country? And I think overall that's something we've kind of always just muddled through.
There has been a change in government in this country in the last year or so, a year and change. Do you see directional changes, directional shifts, if you will?
Well, I definitely see Stephen Harper is definitely cut from a different mold. I would say Chrétien and Martin in particular really kind of emphasize that kind of, you know, that it very much it's in the liberal strain to try and make everyone happy. So you're always, you know, they're always six of one, half a dozen of the other. And a good example of that was, you know, in the whole income trust debacle, in which I think, you know, the liberals knew that it was a real negative for the economy and was going to do some really long term damage as every single Canadian company was about to turn itself into an income trust. And they said they were going to do something and then stepped away because they were just afraid to make that decision. And then the Harper Tories, you know, who had promised that they would never tax the income trust, realized that even though they had made that promise and it was going to cost them politically, they realized that it was, you know, it was kind of like bad medicine. You have to take it. Even though it's painful, it's something you've got to do for the long-term sustainability of your economy. So they did that, and I thought that actually was a great example of leadership.
We're talking with Andrea Mandel Campbell. The book is called Why Mexicans Don't Drink Molson, $34.95 from Douglas and McIntyre. You give examples of countries who have fared well internationally. What can Canada learn from those countries? And I'm thinking two in particular, Finland and Australia.
Well, in the case of Finland is a good example because I think that they had a strategy. And their strategy was that they're very pro-business, which is something that I think it's difficult for Canadians to embrace. And their government was shameless, really, in approaching business and saying, you know, what can we do for you? And they basically went about, you know, there was a very nice kind of, I refer to it as like a three three-legged stool where there was a real strategy between government, business, and academia to come up with, you know, strategies for producing globally competitive products and designs. And so you had academia on the one hand, where you had former people who had been in business, who were professors, who were lecturing and teaching, who were, you know, directing their research, which, you know, it was being supported by government, directing their research to products that these businesses were interested and needed. So it was, you know, they were very closely aligned with, you know, supporting businesses in kind of developing their product lines. And so there's a real kind of, you know, virtuous circle happening there, which really doesn't happen in Canada. I think there's a big disconnect where government just funds, you know, they'll put money to research chairs, but it'll have no connection to necessarily the demands of business. And so, as I say in my book, it's kind of like toddlers, you know, you put them in a room and they parallel play, you know, they may be touching some of the same toys, but they don't really play together. I think Australia is another good example, because it's a country that in many ways is much like Canada. It has the same kind of history of, you know, of British Commonwealth, a multicultural, resource-based economy. And they actually, it's really quite interesting how they had a lot of this very similar regulatory and government structures in place. They had the wheat board. Well, they still have a wheat board, which is, you know, a market monopoly on the export of wheat and other grains. They had milk marketing boards like we do here, and they had protection over their telecommunications industry. Basically, foreigners were not allowed to buy into it, and they had protections regarding their banking industry. And they, you know, they basically went bankrupt in the late early 90s, and they had no choice but to kind of open up their economy. And they dismantled the marketing system, marketing boards. The wheat board has been largely dismantled. It was publicly listed, and it's expected that the monopoly will also be removed. They got rid of, they actually just have allowed the foreign acquisition of an investment into their telecommunications sector. And in terms of banking, they've allowed their banks to buy insurance companies, something that's still not allowed here in Canada. And they have allowed foreign competition into the market. And it's completely revolutionized their economy in many ways. And they've prospered enormously. So I think that there's a lot of lessons we could learn from Australia.
You're talking to a layperson, so I don't really understand economics and that sort of thing. How does the relaxing the rules on foreign ownership, how does that help Canadian business be successful abroad?
Okay.
Are those connected?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'll give you an example if you want to look at banking, right? I mean, the banks here in Canada, they don't really have to compete. I mean, essentially, you're looking at an oligopoly. You have a gentleman's agreement amongst, you know, five big banks where they make an amazing amount of money, $19 billion in profits last year. And that's pretty incredible when you consider that they have really no global scale or global footprint of any significance. And they've been able to make this money because they are protected. You know, foreigners are not allowed to buy them. And not only that, but foreigners really don't compete in Canada. There's too many obstacles for them to come in and actually compete here in Canada alongside them. So they've been, you know, basically given this market. So what happens? Well, on the one hand, just as a simple consumer, you know, they charge you ATM fees. They charge you all kinds of fees that even in the United States, you know, the Canadian banks that are in the U.S. don't charge ATM fees because they have to compete against the Americans, so they don't charge them. That's just on a simple basis. Then if you go into, you know, support for Canadian business, you know, Canadian businesses that, let's say, need to borrow money, I don't know how often I've heard from Canadian businesses who say they just can't get the support, they can't get the financing, and that's because, you know, there's really almost, in fact, no trade financing done here in Canada anymore. HSBC is the largest provider of export trade finance in Canada because the banks just can't be bothered to do it because they don't need to bother because they don't need to compete. So you end up also really hurting Canadian business ability to finance themselves because the banks can really cherry pick, you know, who they want to lend money to, and they're not willing to take too much risk in terms of who they're going to lend their money to. And then I guess thirdly, because they have no global scale and scope, they can't really support Canadian businesses who go into international markets because, you know, they just don't have the network in China or in India or somewhere else to really support a Canadian company that's going over there. So there are many different ways that this kind of protectionism actually affects business people and consumers.
One of the things you suggest in the book is to dismantle the CRTC. Mm-hmm. Cultural nationalists will say, well, we'll be flooded with American programs and Canadian culture will disappear. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I really think that's a red herring. I mean, I think we've been using that argument forever, and it's only blown up in our faces because we've used, you know, we use that argument now for cultural industries, but we've been using them all along for why we need to, you know, protect the banks, why we need to protect Bell Canada. And the end result is that instead of creating national champions, what we have are these, like, companies that are basically too big for Canada but too small for the rest of the world, and they've left them kind of as sitting ducks, as we now see with Bell Canada, which has been sitting here as a stagnant company with nowhere to go, really no opportunity for new growth. So even though there are protections from foreigners buying it, there's still there's a move out there to buy it with backing from American venture capital companies. So I think it's ended up, you know, leaving us with kind of trapping Canadian companies on one hand. And so we used to argue that we needed this for our industrial policy because we needed to have national champions in industry. And now we've kind of moved that argument over to Canadian culture. And I find, I really don't understand why it's important that Canadians own the bookstores in Canada. I really don't see how that would stop Canadians from you know, writing books. I don't see why foreigners couldn't own newspapers in Canada. To me, it's just a bogus argument and another way to continue, you know, protectionism.
Is this the way that the world is going, becoming more globalized? Or is this because the left says that you know, we should you know, be protectionist, we should be nationalist? Do you find that other countries, and you mentioned Finland and Australia in the context of how Canada should become, mm-hmm, in terms of its relationship between business and government and looking globally, mm-hmm, do you think, are other countries taking your examples and putting them into practice?
Well, I mean, I would say the countries that are, you know, like a good example is France, of a country that really is struggling between globalization and a really strong strain of economic nationalism. And the end result is that you have an economy that is stagnating. I mean, the French economy unemployment there is something like 18%, I think. They are not growing their economy enough to provide opportunities for everyone living there, and the end result is social unrest, protests in the streets. So I think the people that are still, you know, trying to hang on to these old ideas of economic nationalism against all the odds and against all the evidence that really shows that the more you open up, the stronger you are, the more competitive you are, and the more, you know, the better equipped you are to provide opportunities for your people. There are still a lot of people who are just, you know, stubbornly refuse to admit to that, but I would just argue that it hasn't, you know, it's not working for us so far, so you just have to look at the results.
Well, what do you think the reaction to your ideas to this book, in this book, is? Do you think Canadians see your way and think that this is the way we should go, or are we sort of clawed back because of the way things were?
Well, I think there's going to be, you know, I think there's going to be a struggle within the Canadian, you know, society about how to go. I mean, I've been surprised by how many people have contacted me to say, you know, this is something that I've always felt very strongly about, but, you know, didn't really know how to, you know, didn't know how to voice it, or you know, this is, you know, especially a lot of people who've spent a lot of time abroad and have seen, you know, worked for other international companies and have seen the way, you know, other companies in other countries approach international markets, and have, you know, for a long time, you know, really been scratching their heads as to why it is that Canada isn't doing more. So I've had a lot of that, but of course I expect that there is going to be a knee-jerk reaction, because, you know, part of the problem, I think, for Canadians is it's been, you know, we're kind of bad at change, and we kind of rather stick with the devil we know than the devil we don't know. So we're less apt to go out there and take a risk, because for fear that we'll lose what we have, rather than looking at the potential for all we could gain. So yeah, there's going to be, you know, I expect that there's going to be people who for whatever reason, you know, don't want to open their minds and to these ideas. But from my perspective, I mean, I spent 3 years researching this, talking to hundreds of people all around the world and across the country, and I made sure to back up my point from as many perspectives as I could. And the way I see it, the evidence is pretty incontrovertible.
It's a really interesting book, and congratulations on it. Continued good luck with it, and thanks for joining us today, Andrea.
Oh, well, thank you for taking the time to talk to me.